to introduce the podcast, Jazza.
Shall I introduce... hello, podcast listeners. My name's Jazza. You're so annoying. Why are you talking up with my introduction, John? How fucking dare you? John has just picked up a couple of candles that are on my dining table and gone, oh, they are scented.
I feel like that would help with the cold open.
He sniffed one and then put it down and sniffed the other just to check whether they were both scented the same.
Why are you...
The great thing is, it doesn't matter what level of burnt down they are, they all smell of roses.
You might be surprised to know, dear listener, that we are the Right Dishonourable podcast and we talk about politics, social issues and current events every week.
It might be bubblegum.
When we're not talking about the scent of really cheap candles from Tiger. As I said, my name is Jazza. I go by Jazza John on the internet. And I am joined today by two wonderful gentlemen whose names also begin with J. Jimmy, would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, as Jazza has just indicated, I'm Jimmy Nichols. And I go by Jimmy Nichols on the internet.
No.
And in real life, too.
Shock horror. And John, the one obsessed with scented candles.
And I'm John Cervanti. I go by Donkey OK on Twitter. The Twitter I tweet sometimes, never.
Very good. That was the hardest sell of one social media that I've ever come across. Well done. How was everybody's week? Just finished doing the culture cast, so we're already sick of each other's company, to be completely honest.
I was sick before we started the culture cast, if I'm honest.
Now I'm just fuming. If you'd like to know more about the culture cast, then you can go to youtube.com/rightdishonourable. Or you can just go to our website, which is rightdishonourable.com. Is there anything else that we want to say in the cold open at all?
Just send us money, please.
We haven't got a way for them to send us money.
Just send it in the post. It'll be all right.
Just write on an envelope for three amazing people, and I'm sure it will find its way to us.
What has happened to this?
Should we talk about what topics we're going to cover in this week?
Yeah, so we shirked this last week because there were other topics that we were really interested in, and we're kind of sick of talking about UK possibly leaving the EU. But we're going to talk about Brexit today. Because loads of stuff has happened. David Cameron last week announced the date of the referendum being the 23rd of June, and now the campaigns have gone in full force. We have several members of the Conservative Party, of the current government, who have declared themselves for out, which goes contrary to the Prime Minister and the majority of his cabinet colleagues' view. And this includes Michael Gove, and Boris Johnson, the current Mayor of London, and as I said in my video that I made this week, Giant Baby.
Is it weird that whenever I hear his name, I just, for some reason, think Bobo the Monkey?
Well, no, he's called Bojo, isn't he?
He is called hashtag Bojo.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Very exciting.
Bojo the monkey.
I'm really
the blonde monkey.
Bojo the blonde monkey. That's a children's book if I ever heard one. Jimmy, what's our second topic?
Our second topic is based on this report from the Sutton Trust, which is a think tank that concerns itself with inequality. They publish one of these every year, but it's the figures for which of the leading professions in the UK are dominated by the privately educated. Privately educated kids account for about 7% of our education system, although the figure's slightly higher if you include people that move into private secondary schools, as in independent fee-paying schools, because we have slightly confused terminology around public and private and what have you. But just to give some examples, it's... 3/4 of the judiciary, 71% of barristers, 71% of top military figures, 61% of doctors, half of top journalists, for instance. So, basically, the problem...
Are we included in the top journalist statistics?
I don't think so.
Well, that's a shame.
Maybe next year.
We'd have only made it look worse, seeing as we are all privately educated.
That is true, yeah.
Welcome to this is the lens through which we see the world, everybody.
So we're going to be talking about that so Jazza can talk about diversity in a way that doesn't concern sex or skin colour. You can talk about money instead.
You're putting this on me, but you just really enjoy goading me, I think.
It's fantastic fun, yeah.
And talking about goading, John and I have ganged up on Jimmy to have the Eurovision as our third topic, haven't we, John?
Yes, the yet another awards ceremony that is clearly not relevant because it does not award Kanye West the best.
I mean, it's only a matter of time before he represents Romania, I think. For those who don't know, for non-European listeners to the podcast, the Eurovision is the largest non...
I love the idea that somebody just... Doesn't anywhere across the ocean listens to
this. Oh, I thought we do.
If you are a US listener, let us know. Give us a tweet at Right Dishonour. But for those of you who don't know, the Eurovision Song Contest is the largest non-sporting televised event that is hosted every year, and it essentially sees each European and some non-European countries.
I think Australia kind of counts. There's a lot of white people there.
So Australia are a new addition to the Eurovision Song Contest, but also Israel, which I don't think many people see Israel as being a part of Europe.
Yeah, but their neighbours don't really like them.
Is this the first year that Australia's taken part?
Second year.
So
didn't they say it was going to be a one-off the first time?
They did say it was going to be a one-off.
Which was the first year that they did it?
Last year.
Did they market that as Eurovision Prison Edition?
To all our Australian listeners, I'm deeply sorry. But basically it sees all of the European and some non-European countries present a song that is then voted on by the public and by a jury that represents each country. And then winners are declared.
I mean, we need to get Canada involved in this.
Somebody created a list of, like, the next countries that would be most likely to join the Eurovision. You know what's top?
China?
China.
Wow. Really?
That great European nation.
Japan would have been a more obvious one.
That's further away from Europe. Or nearer,
I don't think geography matters, seeing as Australia is literally as far away from Europe as it can possibly
be. Because they bloody love shit music.
That's true.
That's not very nice. I love Korean pop music. Anyway, we are diverging from, as usual, from our line of thought. Anything else we want to say in the intro, or shall we just go straight into Brexit?
Straight into Brexit.
Excellent.
Last week there's been quite a few developments around the whole EU referendum because Cameron finally got the deal that he wanted the deal. I mean, it was a deal. It was a shit deal. It doesn't really mean anything, but it does mean that the from a political point of view, that the members of the cabinet who want to campaign for Brexit are now allowed to. And as Jazz alluded to in the intro to this podcast, that includes Boris Johnson, the Mayor of London, Michael Gove, the Justice Secretary, who's now rumoured to be potentially losing his job over his decision
to
campaign. It's a good rumour.
I am a fan of Gove because he is probably the only person on the Out campaign who is prominent at the moment, who doesn't come across as a swivel-eyed loony.
Yeah, I mean, mentioning swivel-eyed loonies, we have Chris Grayling, leader of the House of Commons and noted swivel-eyed loony, and Ian Duncan-Smith, who, you know, when he's not busy campaigning for Brexit, is, you know, killing disabled people with his bare hands.
Yeah, because just as you do. Also, like a series of other people with, members of Parliament with minor roles in the cabinet, Priti Patel.
Priti Patel, who does bring some diversity to the Brexit campaign.
Did you see? So they had everybody in the cabinet announced that they were for out. They had to leave a cabinet meeting through the back door and then did a press conference there, and they were kind of basically presented what looked like a check, but it was like, we're for out, and they'd pushed all of the women and the people of colour towards the front of the thing, but then the group behind them was all white men, and I was like, at least you tried with a little bit of diversity. But I don't think that necessarily has anything to do with the way that people are likely to vote per se, but I think that's more indicative of just what the Conservative Party looks like.
I think the most interesting development this week was Bojo coming out in...
As you now know that he's called...
As I now know
Bojo, he's called... Bojo the blonde-haired monkey.
Bojo supporting Boris Johnson. Hashtag Brexit. I think that's the most interesting thing to come out of this week.
Is it interesting, or did we see it coming?
He's fucking so badly gunning for the Prime Minister's job at this point. He's banking on the fact that Cameron's going to lose this and will have to resign, and because he was on the right side He will get
both literally and metaphorically.
He'll get the Prime Minister's job. Because let's face it, he's got like an unprecedented record of getting people to vote for him.
Everybody sees through that, though, right? Everybody knows that Boris Johnson's heart isn't in this.
I think all of the seasoned political commentators and the people who follow politics know that Boris Johnson is a bit of a fraud.
No, but what about the public?
The public, I'm not so sure about.
I don't know.
Because he has a track record of getting Labour voters to vote for him, despite the fact he's took. Because he's not afraid to. As this is a beautiful fucking example of the play that he always does, which is go against party lines to grab voters from other parties. So he's going against the Prime Minister here to grab. If obviously this all goes south and Cameron has to resign, he's seen as being somebody who, like, he's a Tory, but, you know, he's not afraid to go against what the real Tories think, so just vote for me, fellas. Just, you know, come on. I know you might like being a bit of a Labour voter every now and again. I mean, who doesn't enjoy it at the weekend? But come over to Team Mojo.
What I found quite, like, it made me roll my eyes, to be completely honest, but when he did announce last weekend that he was going to be for OUT, he couldn't think of the name of the OUT campaign. And to be fair, there are, like, four or five
there's
OUT
a lot
campaigns,
of campaigns
now.
Yeah.
But he couldn't name one, and he was like, vote Leave or Leave, or, like, whichever one is, like, the main one. it was almost like he hadn't really talked to anybody.
That's all practice, though, isn't it? That's all bollocks. He knows exactly which campaigns
yeah,
he's
no,
doing.
You're probably right. It's he also apparently told the Prime Minister that he was
via text.
Yeah, yeah. It's like
that's the classiest way to break up with someone, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. But they have what was something that has been quite amusing to read about in the press is the lifelong rivalry between Boris Johnson and David Cameron. They went to the same school, the same university.
They weren't in the same year, though.
No, so Boris was like a prefect, older than him, cooler than David Cameron.
And wasn't Boris president of the Billingdon Club?
I don't know. Billingdon Club true. Being a club that has a terrible reputation at Oxford University when they go around and destroy
restaurants.
Yeah. He was definitely the president of the Oxford Union, and that apparently pissed Cameron off.
Is that true?
Yeah, that is. I'm pretty sure that's true.
Basically, they have this rivalry where Cameron has a bit of an inferiority complex and Boris is probably a little bit pissed off that he didn't get to the prime ministership first.
Yeah.
That's the backstory. But it does make me slightly annoyed that our whole kind of the future of the country and the European is based on a really childish.
I think that might be a bit post hoc, actually. I'm not sure there's very much in that.
No, that apparently, it's all anecdotal evidence, to be fair, based on people who know them both, but anecdotally that is meant
anecdotally, kind of like the pig thing.
Exactly, and we all believe that Cameron fucked
us believe that Cameron fucked
No one of any substance really believes it, but it is a funny thing to mention.
Are you saying I am not of substance?
I'm saying you don't believe it, Jason.
It's very fun every now and again to tweet the Prime Minister.
True. I don't care whether it's true or not. I'm willing it to be true.
And it's quite fun to tweet the Prime Minister every now and again saying, are you telling Porky?
Yeah, exactly.
That is a good joke. Jazzy, you must be having kittens over this whole... In another animal-based metaphor.
Thank you, this whole
scenario. You haven't had a chance recently to, you know, angst publicly about, you know, your feelings on Brexit.
Are you referencing the video that I uploaded?
Or on the podcast, at least.
On the podcast, yeah. No, I haven't. So for those who haven't been listening to the saga of Jazza get stressed about Brexit on The Right Dishonourable, I'm probably the most pro-EU out of the three of us, I would say.
For sure,
because I have, for whatever reason, just by chance of my upbringing, I have quite an emotional attachment to the European Union beyond, practicality. And so it would actually take quite a lot for me to vote out. But yeah, I'm stressed as fuck. I'm so worried that we're going to leave, and then we will end up sending a shockwave both economically and politically throughout not just Europe but the world.
Do you feel that the EU, the EU has a lot of good programs, it had a lot of good effects. Mm-hmm. That's kind of indisputable. But do you not feel that in terms of the governance model of the EU, there's something very unlovable about it?
No, I agree. Like there's the phrase is battered around a lot and it's become almost cliche, but there is a democratic deficit.
Yeah, because...
But there's also a democratic deficit in our own politics in the UK.
But it
doesn't mean that I want to declare Essex independent.
It's worse in the EU, though, isn't it?
I don't think
that it is.
So the way the EU is structured is the executive arm, which is the one that proposes legislation, is called the EU Commission. That's made up of 28 commissioners, which are appointed by the 28 presidents and prime ministers of each country. Mm-hmm. So there's obviously
the governments of each country.
Yeah, there's a lot of jump to you. There's a lot of separation between what the voters vote for, which is the government in their own country, compared to who is appointed. And therefore, there's very little control and very little accountability as to who those people are and what it is they do. That's the essence of the democratic deficit in the EU. I don't feel there's any comparable thing in the UK.
House of Lords.
But the House of Lords doesn't...
It's almost parallel.
No, because the EU Commission has a lot of very substantial power. The House of Lords has some very minor editorial powers.
And also are able to send back legislation, as we've seen.
What are talking about? We know what the real issue is here, and we know why we should leave the EU, and that's immigration, mate.
So this is the fair point, right? The reason that we're having this, referendum... Although there are genuinely legitimate arguments for going up because of the democratic deficit, because of the fact that people can claim benefits. I understand lots of the grievance.
Yeah, migrants claiming benefits, that's a big one.
argument. That's been disproved time and time again.
But people are still voting on that.
What are you talking about?
John
has slipped into character.
John is taking the piss at the moment, just to allow you to...
It's to do with benefits, mate.
But the reason that we're doing this is because of xenophobia and because of immigration and because of fears of high levels of immigration into the UK. And that's what is really difficult for me to stomach, because I think that we are better for having high levels of immigration.
I totally agree with you. This is my entire problem. This is what I'm exasperated to the point of actually almost just not caring anymore about... Every day you read in the paper or watch the news and it's the same bloody stuff. It's all to do with, you know... there's immigration and people are worried about immigration and we should leave because of immigration. And there are very few facts that are being...
And there are problems with immigration. So, for example, when people do come here to claim specifically benefits, although that is such a small percentage of people, of course people shouldn't be doing that. That should be something that is stopped. But that doesn't mean that you should reduce immigration just for reducing immigration's sake. And that's exactly what this government has done
you've pinned it all on xenophobia. But there is actually a lot of the migrants that come in from Europe do low-skilled work and therefore put downward pressure on wages for low-skilled work. That's a legitimate problem, and you can look up the statistics.
And we've talked about it on the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, that's a genuine thing. I'm not personally bothered about
that. But I think that I feel like the reason that people are anti-EU is because they go into Tesco and they see a Polish shelf. I think that that's the thing that irks them, and they go to Costa and somebody serves them with an accent. That's the issue for them.
It's
not necessarily
quite that. I mean, I do think there's an element of that, but I think the wider problem is just that there's so much information and people. You know, there's a lot of scaremongering. So I spoke to some people in my family who admittedly...
That word, scaremongering.
Who admittedly aren't like a great touchstone. But, you know, there were common themes and common worries that were coming up. I should mention that my family are predominantly working class. So I think it's an interesting, you know, point of like a source.
We talked to some poor people.
We talked to poor people. Terrorism came up, worries about, you know, Muslims and Syrians and God knows what else coming to the country. People nicking benefits and just the immigration getting out of control. Those are the only three things that came up time and time again. And they didn't know any facts about any of it. They didn't know, for example, that actually a huge proportion of people who come into this country every year are from outside the EU, and that even if we leave the EU, we're still going to have the people from outside the EU trying to get here.
They'd not be in favour of the migration from outside of the EU.
No,
but obviously
that's not what the out campaign says. A lot of so that UKIP have kind of shifted their rhetoric on immigration to say rather than we should reduce immigration is let's have a fair immigration policy that treats all immigrants equally. Mm. And that's very clever because it allows people to say that they don't want immigration without actually having to admit that they're quite uncomfortable. And I admit that I'm painting quite a lot of people with the same brush here. There are a huge number of people who genuinely have grievances with the way that the EU is structured and with the amount of sovereignty that the UK has. And those are the reasons that they want to leave. I do understand that. But you cannot deny that the vast majority of people and the reason that we are having this referendum is because of the immigration problem.
Yeah,
I think
problem in quotation
marks. I think that's true, but that's in some ways just the way that UKIP has played it, is that they managed to marry the immigration issue very closely to the EU issue and therefore force a vote on the
EU
issue.
That's why in some ways I don't think we should be having this vote, because I'm all in favour of democracy, but we're not having a vote on...
But not when they could do something that I disagree with.
Well, it's just we're not having a vote on an informed basis.
No votes are conducted on an informed basis.
But this is really important, because our generation are going to have to deal with this. The generation after us is going to have to deal with this. This could have really big impacts for the country.
Well, it would have a big impact whether or not we voted on it.
It's not like a general election, right, where if you make the wrong decision to a degree, there are things to mitigate it. You have an opposition party, you can impeach people, you can have votes of no confidence.
It's possible in several decades' time that we could re-enter the EU having left it.
Yeah, but exactly in several decades' time.
It's reversible. It is a reversible proposal.
Easily, but then what is the chance of us being able to get, like, quote-unquote, a good deal?
You just said yourself...
I don't think we were to leave, if we reapplied, and we wouldn't get all of the opt-outs that we've managed to negotiate.
This is part of the problem, I think, in that, for whatever reason, either people seem to not care... Well, like, because this is politics, people seem to either not care at all or are incredibly impassioned about it and see it very much as a black-and-white issue and as a correct decision and an incorrect decision. Whereas actually, you know what, in the long term, we would be fine in or out of the EU. It's just about what you want the role of the UK to be going forward, working in the continent that we are part of and with the wider world.
But the
things that are inevitable are that there's going to be a huge shock to our economy and to all of our neighbours' economies if we do choose to leave. Anybody who says that isn't going to happen is frankly lying, because as soon as Boris Johnson even mutters the words, "Oh, I'm out, I want to vote out of the EU," our currency depleted by like huge, I can't remember how much it was, by like huge percentage points against the dollar because of speculation about our future.
It dropped to the lowest point in comparison to the dollar that it's been since 2009. Which is shortly after the financial crash.
And that is just a taster of what would happen if we were actually to leave the EU.
But that's actually more to do, I think, with uncertainty than it is to do with leaving, because at least once businesses there's obviously stuff that businesses want and don't want, but the thing that usually rocks markets is uncertainty.
But there will be huge periods of uncertainty if we leave, because there will be, you know, renegotiations that need to happen. And as many commentators have pointed out this week, if we leave, the EU might be inclined to not negotiate contracts with us favourably, because they will want to make a point to other EU member states that it's not.
Yeah, so there has been a lot of talk about the possibility of us creating a domino effect with other Eurosceptic countries,
which they will try
like
to
the Netherlands, I guess Finland would
and
have
it makes
a much
sense
harder time.
If I was part of the EU Parliament after we leave, I would make it incredibly hard for anyone else to leave.
These are very highbrow economic arguments there.
That's the thing, the whole EU referendum should be a really carefully considered thing.
Yeah.
But nobody, frankly, has the bloody time to be able to do that, and nobody is willing to make that actual case, is why we have the word scaremongering being thrown around so much.
You could have said the same thing about the Scottish referendum.
I think exactly the same thing.
And ultimately, the people voting on where they want to be governed from, which is ultimately what this is about, is never going to be as well informed as you'd like it to be.
Actually, no, I disagree with you. A lot of the Scottish referendum, the reason I didn't really comment on it, like from a personal level, was because to me, me, the Scottish referendum, rightly or wrongly, was essentially about colonialism and people being still upset that,
The Scots were one of the chief colonialists in the British Empire. They punched well above their weight. It's just wrong.
That's Jimmy up to the pitch and he whacks it for six.
Regardless of what you think, to the Scottish people, it was an issue of whether or not they wanted to leave. Basically, having independence, they
to still be dominated by England.
Yeah,
like that was legitimately something.
It was like for them, it was an emotional issue. It wasn't really the kind of scope that this.
But no, but that's my point. Is that this is an emotional issue?
Well, yeah,
isn't
this,
it?
But so many people
aren't emotional about it. I think that's the issue.
Well, no, I think
so. You were complaining that it was too emotionally charged, but you're also saying it's not emotionally charged enough.
I'm saying that those who are interested in this and who are engaging with this are incredibly emotionally charged and are either or. And the people who are perhaps like you, who are more on the fence and aren't particularly emotionally invested either way, they're the majority in this, I think.
I wouldn't say that's true. I'd say the majority of people who want to leave because of immigration. And I think that's really...
They're the loudest voice.
The polling doesn't bear that out.
So we haven't. Had a poll since Boris announced his position?
It's hovering at around 40% for each side, basically. Depending on which poll you look at, but 40% is not even a majority of the whole public.
Should we listen to the polls again? Yeah, like exactly. They fucked up at the Scottish referendum.
They're a better measure than anything else we have.
What worries me is if you look in terms of the.
Yeah,
last
but we asked poor people, Jimmy.
If you look in terms of the last general election at the number of people who voted UKIP, you can safely assume all of them won. Us out of the UK.
You shouldn't assume, because there will be some people who voted for UKIP at the last general election that will vote to stay in.
Okay, alright, but let's take what I just said loosely to be true, despite the fact you pointed out it wouldn't be. Let's take it loosely to be true that all UKIP voters want out of the UK. Hmm. Add to that a large proportion of Tory voters.
It's 70% of the Tory
decent proportion of maybe Labour voters as well.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn has yet to start actually making
it. Yeah, but scary.
You said that the majority of people are going to vote on this on the basis of immigration. That simply does not bear out in the polls. If only 40% of people are even considering voting to leave the EU, to say that, you know, most people are voting because of immigration is insane, because it cannot be more than 40% by definition.
But it is the biggest issue. Whenever you talk to voters in the UK, the NHS and
it is a big issue, but there's 40% of people who are voting to stay in. Presumably immigration is not that big of an issue for them.
Probably a big issue for them in a different way, and I think that they probably are voting for something different other than a great attachment to the EU, which is something different that... It's all structured very differently to the Scottish referendum. But what really worries me is low turnout. There was a quite obvious article that got published today, I think, in The Independent, that said that if all of the maybes who we're assuming are going to vote to stay, because that's just what the British public is like, we quite like status quo. Referendums in general in the UK tend to stick with the status quo. If they choose not to turn out on the 23rd of June, and also it's when Glastonbury is, and they're all going to be buggered, aren't they?
I
worry that it's going to be won by a load of very impassioned people. We know that UKIP voters turn out en masse, but that's why they win the European elections.
I think it's legitimate if someone's not sure or doesn't really care enough about the issue for them not to vote.
Yeah,
I mean, I've actually considered that I might not vote in this election.
Don't do that. No, I'll have to unfriend you.
If on the day I decide I actually can't choose between either position, the only rational thing to do is not to vote, is to abstain from the votes.
Spoil the ballot.
Okay, I could do that.
Do that, please. All right. Thank you. We've spoken on this inevitably for a very long time.
Wait, can I actually have predictions? What's your... Of you two, do you think we're going to leave?
I predict we're going to talk about this probably every week between now.
And I want a prediction every week.
You want a prediction every week?
Well, we are probably going to be covering Brexit quite a lot in the next few months.
But do you feel we're going to leave?
Yeah, realistically, yeah.
My heart says... stay. My gut fears leaving. So I think we might actually end up leaving.
Too close to call at this point.
Well, yeah, probably.
And that's why I call you an optimist.
Excellent. Very good. Let's talk about diversity now. Okay.
This week, the Sutton Trust, which is a think tank dedicated to equality, produced its annual report on the number of private school pupils or former private school pupils which dominate the UK's top professions. As I said, this includes things like the law, the military, medicine, journalism, politics as well, the civil service and just general business, which actually does the best out of all the ones I've listed. Only 34% of the CEOs of, I believe these are FTSE companies that they looked at, were actually educated at private schools.
Mm-hmm.
But this is obviously a sore point in British politics. Only 7% of school children are actually educated at private fee-paying schools, at least up until the sixth form, which is the last 2 years in the British secondary education system. The figures, so for instance, in journalism, half of the top 100 journalists were privately educated. In the judiciary, which judges basically, it was three quarters. All the figures are pretty bad, but...
So you admit that it is bad?
I don't necessarily think it is bad. I mean, it's bad from the Sutton Trust point of view, perhaps. But actually, John, we were talking about this before we started recording the podcast, and you actually said some of the figures were lower than what you expected.
I genuinely, the first time I read through it, I was actually a bit surprised, because my cynical brain would have thought it was much worse than it actually is. I would have thought that a higher proportion of private educated people would get a higher proportion of the best jobs. I was actually surprised, basically, by how many state school pupils managed to get decent jobs.
So,
which I know is like a very, a bad thing to say, but still.
Yeah, but it's still tiny.
Oh, it's awful. I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying I was actually a bit surprised.
So why do both of you think this is bad, then?
I think that this is bad because it is discouraging for people. There's the idea of being able to make it no matter where you're from, right? Which, if this... Well, this shows that that is an absolute fallacy. And I think that we should be engineering...
It doesn't show it's an absolute fallacy. It shows that if you go to private school, you're relatively more likely to end up with a top job.
You're much more likely.
Yeah, but you being able to go to private school has more to do with how much you're... parents are able to pay and how much they're able to invest time and money in your education rather than your innate ability.
I think this actually, just before we...
You're cocking an eyebrow at me.
So the thing that strikes me about these stats is that obviously a lot of people have read a great deal into them. What it actually shows is a correlation between people who went to private school and people who end up in top jobs. It doesn't really suggest very much about the mechanisms by which that happens. I mean, one thing that does strike me is even if you abolished all of the private schools tomorrow, you would still get a very high proportion of school children born into wealthy families that ended up in the top jobs. You just would have to find some other way of measuring it.
But that's the issue, I think. That there isn't social mobility, and I feel like we should live in a society where there is social mobility, both up and down.
I think this one of the things that gets left out of this discussion an awful lot is people sort of demonise the private school pupils themselves. It's important.
And as for me, private school.
Well, but I mean, it's important to remember. For example, I had no say over what school I went to. I was never asked. I was told these were the schools that I could go to, and I was going to go to one of them. Because my mum was having been through a state school system that she felt failed her, was absolutely adamant I was going to private school because she didn't want an education system to fail me.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, from her point of view, she was being quite noble. Obviously, you can argue that, there are a lot of problems with that. But my point being that I was never given any choice. I was never allowed to even think about going to a state school. It was only private schools I was given options of going to.
I was given an option of... Well, I took the 11 plus. I'm not sure if that still actually technically exists now.
I don't think it does exist anymore.
But I didn't get in. But I managed to get... So I went to a private school, but on scholarship. Because I did well in that exam, but not in the grammar school exam.
Hmm.
Although I am from the demographic that typically goes to a private school. So why they were giving me a scholarship, I'm not overly aware, to be completely honest, because we would have been fine anyway. I think that it's a great shame, but it doesn't come as a surprise to me because we know that this is what the UK is like, right? It just depresses me a little bit. Sorry, I'm all bludgeoned.
You said earlier that you thought that people should be given top jobs or progress through life more on the basis of their innate ability as opposed to the wealth of their family.
No, I don't think that people should be given top jobs because of their innate ability. I think that the correct person for the job should be able to get the right job. But you change that, you change the person who is going to be shortlisted for those kinds of positions by making sure that education is as outstanding as possible throughout as many schools as possible, and that there is... I don't like the idea of there being... I guess an example would be all public school... or all state school shortlists. Like, that just seems really stupid to me. But you want to make sure that state school kids who do have that innate ability are going to be able to be lifted up in some sort of a way so that they are able to become the next great barrister and the next great so-and-so or whatever. Because if you think that these kinds of statistics are just, it implies that you believe that people are more able and capable of doing these jobs in terms of their innate ability because of the amount of money that their parents
have got over the past year, and that's
obviously not true.
I think because any sensible person, when you think about it, realises that, say, 10 A's achieved by a state school pupil is much more impressive than 10 A's
It depends on the state school, to be honest with you.
No, of course it does.
But in general, that rule holds true. If you have a kid from a state school who's managed to get 10 A's, it's much more impressive than a kid from a private school. Because private schools basically enter into a contract with parents to say, look, no matter what, we're going to get your kids really good grades. Whereas state schools kind of have to do the best with what they can.
Is there a solution to this, guys? I feel like we all agree. Do we all agree that this is not a good thing? What do you
think,
Jimmy?
I'm not actually sure. I'm not sure what I think.
Oh, dear. Oh, no.
It's this thing about innate ability, and I know you were sort of a bit fuzzy on... You seem to think that, I guess, people who work hardest should get the top jobs.
Yes. Essentially, and also the smartest people. Being a smart person does not mean that you pass exams with high grades necessarily, and it doesn't mean that you went to this school and were taught how to write a cover letter and were taught how to apply for university and were taught what UCAS was. Like, that shouldn't be a barrier. Everybody should be able to benefit from that kind of knowledge and that kind of buoyancy.
It's still kind of all relative, isn't it? So if state school pupils were, say, all taught to write brilliant cover letters, the private school pupils they'd have to teach them something else to give them another leg up over the state school pupils.
But that's a bad thing, because it implies that state school kids aren't able to provide as much for the community and be able to, for example, go on to university and be able to learn just as much as somebody from a privately educated background.
Can I say, from my point of view, as somebody with quite a lot of working class family, and I know that this is purely anecdotal and experiential, but from my point of view, the problem is that people in lower classes and people who only have the options to go to state schools quite often aren't allowed to be as aspirational as kids who
I
go
completely
to
agree. Going to university or not was not an option for me.
We were told
exactly. Everybody in our school goes to university.
Exactly.
We were told the same thing.
I know a lot of people in my family for whom university is like a distant dream. Like, really? Mm-hmm. I could go to university? And decent jobs as well are a distant dream. They're quite... A lot of people in my family are quite happy to accept what most people would consider remedial jobs, because they think that that's all they can realistically get out of life. And I think we need a culture change to encourage people to... Like, the American dream idea is flawed and, you know, whatever as you like to think of it. It's nice from the point of view of people do genuinely believe in a lot of parts of America that they can theoretically become whatever they want.
I don't think that exists here.
Well, yeah, exactly. We don't have that culture here at all. We don't have a culture where poor people genuinely believe, that, in my experience anyway, that they can become whatever they want, and it's depressing.
And there are consequences when you do have when you are pulling some of the top jobs and the biggest decision makers in terms of law and finance and politics. When you're pulling so many people from such a small section of society, you end up having a society that doesn't necessarily work for the other 93% of people that went to state school. You end up not having those voices yet. And I know that, Jimmy, you have a problem with like the idea that people who are not from certain backgrounds cannot be advocates for a particular group or whatever. But I think that you do miss out on those really authentic voices of people who did, for example, grow up from single-parent families or from poverty or from ethnic minorities. And you end up having really stale higher echelons of society, and that depresses the fuck out of me. Mm. What was interesting was how many people in the arts were from state school backgrounds.
Yeah, this has been an ongoing thing for a while now that... I mean, the classic example would be Eddie Redmayne as a former Etonian who's now one of Britain's leading actors. Benedict Cumberbatch, I think, was from Eton as well.
Who thinks that he gets the equivalent of racism because he's posh. It is something that I don't think he called it racism, but he was like, oh yeah, it's the hardest thing to be a posh man because people mock you or whatever. And I'm like, fuck off, mate.
There's a Chris Rock line of people who have the most shit get to say the least shit, which Benedict should probably be aware of in future. Yeah. We shouldn't slag him off again. It went very badly last time.
Check in terms of the arts, proportionately rich people got into the arts more than.
So for the BAFTAs, 42% of BAFTA nominations are from independent school backgrounds, which is still pretty high. But for pop music, for Brit Award nominations, it was only 19, which was the lowest in all of the
sections. Well, I mean, pop music, I suppose, is like the ultimate sign of pop culture in this country anyway. I think we're more interested in our pop stars than our movie stars.
I feel like the pop music and the criteria there, that was for Brit nominations. The Brits, people forget that the Brit nominations are based around like the Brit School, which is the majority of our very successful, commercially successful artists, musicians go to study in the UK.
And it
counts as a state school.
The thing is,
and they nominate the majority of their graduates, funnily enough. So that's probably quite skewed, even though that statistic looks particularly optimistic.
One of the big problems with trying to become any type of artist in this country, the same as trying to become an academic, actually, funnily enough, is that there's just not the funding for it. So you need private sponsors, i.e. a rich mum and dad.
Or the Brit School, which gets an awful lot of public.
But I mean, like, the reason that a lot of rich people manage to break through as artists is because they are just... It's because trying to become an artist in many ways is like sort of facing attrition. Because your income is going to be famine and feast for a lot of it, and you're going to take a long time to get off the ground. So if you have mummy and daddy paying all the bills,
mummy and daddy have a flat in Marylebone
that you can live in and just invite your friends round every now and again. I think life's going to be much easier than if you're somebody who is a beautiful painter but can't pay any fucking bills.
Is this fixable? Should it
I wonder, there presumably is a balance in a free society. People with more money are probably going to win more than people without money. And there's probably a balance to be had between maintaining a degree of freedom in what people can do and yet also addressing these problems of access that has been highlighted by this report.
So what I have advocated for in the past is independent schools. The vast majority of them are counted as charities. For them to be able to maintain those charitable statuses so that they pay less tax, frankly, is the reason that they are counted as that. They need to have a higher proportion of people from lower income backgrounds.
Poorer people.
Poorer people, lower income backgrounds. Fine.
more bursaries, more scholarships.
Yeah, they need to have a certain percentage for them to be able to maintain those kinds of benefits.
I think that's true.
That seems a reasonable ask.
That's like a first.
It's true of universities as well. And I actually think that grants for the arts and stuff like that should actually, although I'm not very up on what grants for the arts are offered, but I think there should be greater access for people on low income for that. Because, for example, there are certain things you can't ask for in grants for the arts, like living expenses to a degree for some.
There was a woman who got like £20,000 funding
for
her to live in Glasgow for a year. And it was going to be an installation piece, but she was just going to live in Glasgow for a year. She was
clever.
From London.
Right,
no, it's not clever. It's absolutely ridiculous.
I'd need to be paid a lot more than £20,000 to live in Glasgow.
Oh, no. £20,000 in Glasgow goes a long way.
I should imagine it does, actually. Yeah.
But that's a very good use of the rules.
Frankly, stupid.
Was either of you go for the nuclear option in this and actually abolish independent schools and grammar schools and actually have an entirely comprehensive system? As they do in Sweden, as always comes up in these debates.
I have an issue with that because I think the UK, more so than a lot of our European cousins, has more of a... The population has more of a desire to build up a nest egg that you then pass down to your... children, and I think that is innate in quite a lot of our attitude towards property and our traditional school system. And so I think it's very difficult to take that kind of proposition to the electorate and for it to be popular.
Irrespective of its electoral popularity, is it something that you'd consider doing?
I think that it's something very difficult because I want my kids to have the best possible start in life. And if that means that I have to pay fees for school, then I would probably do that. Mm. But I think
the money to do it, though.
I'm probably gonna be fine. No, statistically, like I'm in a reasonably paid job. I've already got my foot on the property ladder. I'm doing way better than the majority of people my age, and I'm very, very aware of that. But I think,
isn't it a bit hypocritical of you to say you're unhappy with the people using their money to gain benefits for their children in their station in life, basically, and yet you're also willing to play the game yourself.
I didn't say that I was unhappy with people using money in order to better their children, because, like I said, I think that's a really innate thing that is really difficult to kind of beat out of people and disincentivise people to do.
But you're definitely unhappy with the ultimate results of that.
I'm very unhappy with the ultimate results of that, but I don't think that the way of being able to fix that and keeping people on side... which is something that politics doesn't always do. I think that you need to use the institutions that already exist because it turns out that independent schools are really good at getting people into the top jobs. So let's make sure that more people from more diverse backgrounds end up going to those independent schools and having the same access to the resources that we had when we were growing up.
But you'll kind of still have the same problem, though. It'll just be a different slice of people that can't get access to the top
jobs. Yeah, which
jobs.
Is why I think it's a first step.
I wonder whether a good idea would be to tax people who send their kids to private schools. Like, they
maybe
have to pay a tax for the privilege, and those taxes go specifically towards...
Because it's only 7% of the population who are doing
that.
Yeah,
but they're quite a rich
7%.
That'll just make it...
It'll make it even less likely for people for... So, for example, parents who are scraping together, like, loads of money have saved for years and years and years in order to send their kids to these independent schools, which I know a lot of people that I went to school with did. They were not by no means rich, barely middle class, and were struggling to send their kids to these schools, but they were making sacrifices in order to do that. I feel that that punishes them.
It definitely does.
See, I mean, I'm actually in favour of the nuclear option just because, from an emotional point of view, I know so many people who have been, who are never going to get on in life, basically, because they've had shit educations, and I think that's horrible.
But that would still happen. It would just mean that the people who do well are a bit more spread among the comprehensive system.
But like in a utopian universe in my head, we would have really good education that was... sort of open to all.
I think this is why you noted earlier I'm a bit sceptical about this, mm-hmm. this report. This is the reason why, is that ultimately I think rich people will win, and them going to independent schools or independent schools not existing is a little bit irrelevant as far as I'm concerned, because the rich people will win.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most important thing is, you're right from the point of view, the most important thing is a culture change. We need to drive aspiration. We need to basically tell kids from an earlier age that they really can be whatever they want to be, and we need to do...
But, I mean, that's not true for a lot of people.
Well, I'm not saying it's true for everybody.
I feel like for quite a lot of people, that's what's missing.
Don't get me wrong.
I'm not sitting here as a rich white guy saying,
oh, poor people just don't dream enough. What I'm saying is, in my experience, like, that you reach a certain age if you go through the state school system where you're sort of your goals are limited and you're told to be more realistic about what you could actually achieve. And I don't think that's right. I think
you should be given a realistic idea of what you can achieve.
No, because then it restricts what you can do. I completely disagree with that.
It shouldn't be overly restrictive, but there are certain things like, I mean, just to take an obvious example, there was a certain point in all our lives when we realised that we weren't going to be professional athletes. And I imagine that none of us really gave a shit about that. But that's a real thing that happened. And there are equivalent constraints on more intellectual endeavours.
Do you know Frank Lampard? Do you know Frank Lampard?
I do, yeah.
He's a really... He was an England footballer.
Has a very,
still plays
for
Chelsea.
High IQ as well.
Yeah, went to my school. Is one of the only independently educated footballers in the Premier League. Actually, he was told by we went to school many years apart, but we actually ended up sharing a PE teacher. Our PE teacher told him that you should stop with this football malarkey, mate. You're not going to be able to make it. Like, you're not good enough. He was told that at the age of 16.
I'm not saying that people won't ever be given bad advice on the back of that, but telling people that they can achieve anything when they can't is also unhelpful.
I don't think so, because I'm a firm believer that so many things in life are down to how much effort you're
prepared. Well, we know intelligence, for instance, is highly hereditable.
Mm-hmm.
That is actually a huge constraint on human endeavour, especially since the knowledge industries are becoming more and more important. You can dispute that all you like, but the jury is pretty much out on that one.
We've talked about this for a very long time, and I want to close this with something nice and positive. So, children, if you are listening, if you dream big and you aim for the moon, at worst you'll land among the stars.
or a tree blocking the way, which either.
Shall we talk about the Eurovision now and be a little bit more upbeat?
Yes!
Fine. The Eurovision Song Contest, as we said in the introduction, is the world's largest, well, most viewed non-sporting event. Every year it gets about, 200,000 people watching. It's an annual event
is
where each...
All?
Something like... Yeah, yeah, yeah.
200,000?
200... Wait. It's several... No, 200 million, I think.
200 million?
Yeah, surely. I knew there was a two and some zeros.
In the southwest of England.
Where it has several countries, not just from Europe, choosing a song to represent themselves, and then it's a popularity contest to be able to see who wins. Sweden won last year with a singer called Måns Zelmerlöw, and so we're going to Stockholm this year. The UK, for the first time in 5 years, has decided to give the UK public the heavy burden of deciding who we're going to send. We had internal selections for the past 5 years, and now we're going to open it up to the UK, and we just selected Joe and Jack, who nobody's heard of. Jimmy,
why do we love shitty male double acts? Fucking
Anton Deck,
Joe and Jack. Wait, who are the twins with the terrible hair?
You're not talking about Nicky and Sammy.
Jedward.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Jedward. Fucking Jedward.
They're technically Irish. They've been to Eurovision 3 times. Jedward. And they do reasonably well each time they go representing Ireland.
I pity whoever has to.
I'm obsessed with Eurovision. Unapologetically.
So somewhat fulfilling the stereotype of a gay man.
Yeah. I love it when I do fulfill stereotypes every now and again, because it isn't hugely often. I hate Madonna, for example. What do you guys think?
Yeah, but how do you feel about Cher?
Like, indifferent. Believe was a good track.
She does a strong line in political commentary these days on Twitter.
She's glorious on Twitter. I'll give her that much. What are your guys' impressions of Eurovision? John, you first.
We clearly picked the wrong people. There were a woman with the red dress who was, like, the favourite going into it with the Leona. Starts off really
No. What's your impression of Eurovision?
Oh, sorry. Right. I like it when somebody funny wins. I don't care when they take it too seriously. When it's self-serious, it pisses me off. When you have years like the year that Lord won,
I think it's Lordy.
Lordy. Mm. Lord, yeah, Lord. Lord's a New Zealander, isn't she?
Yeah.
When Lordy won, bloody loved it. When somebody serious wins, I'd fuck off.
We did have a really, in the 59th Eurovision a couple of years ago, we had Conchita Wurst, who was a bearded lady drag act.
Yeah, love
that. Win the Eurovision Song Contest with the song that. Rise Like a Phoenix. Out of the ashes. It was like a Bond theme.
So the music is absolutely fucking atrocious. I mean, it really is just beyond the pale. It's actually physically disgusting, the sort of Euro trash that comes out.
Wow. I disagree. Some Eurovision tracks do incredibly well commercially. There was the Common Linnets 2 years ago, who represented the Netherlands, who did kind of like cool Americana music, and that did incredibly well commercially.
It's all awful jazz.
It's Euphoria Abba, from Loreen.
What about Abba? You're not really happy with your case here, John.
What about Abba?
Abba are legendary.
You and I may not like them, but a lot of mums around the country do.
All right, so this is just a personal view, but it is awful, isn't it? The music's horrendous.
So the reason that I think gay men, essentially, listener, I'm using this as an excuse to be able to talk about Eurovision for however many minutes. There's not really anything political here at all, apart from geopolitics.
The voting's kind of interesting. That's the only bit that, like, is amusing, because you can become suddenly very nationalistic for about 10 minutes or however long it takes.
So I've failed to become very nationalistic in the past few years because the UK has failed to provide us with any half-decent acts.
I mean, they're all rubbish, so...
So you can say that, but we've had half-decent acts. Blue represented us back in 2011.
The man makes my case for me. I might as well not be
with
here.
The song Children of the Universe, which is actually a banging tune.
No, Jazza, the music's awful. It really is just...
Do you not think there is something quite nice about... So Eurovision was actually a precursor to the European Union in many ways.
I mean, really says a lot.
No, it genuinely... Because it kind of paved the... It was a chance for Europe to come together post-war to be able to kind of celebrate music and art... and Switzerland.
Is this supposed to be a celebration of music and art?
Yeah, it's meant to be a celebration of music and art.
I thought it was, you know, a demonstration of the pointlessness of life.
I thought
it was a nihilistic
point. No, but isn't there something quite honourable and noble about countries coming together in the name of music?
No.
And the fact that so many people watch.
It's awful.
And
the music is so awful.
How do you respond to the idea that this could be a very interesting touchstone for how the European Union feel about us leaving Europe? Will they let us win because they want us to stay?
They'll vote us down. And by vote us down, I mean justly ignore us.
Yeah. The worst thing is, actually, we're one of the chief contributors financially to the Eurovision.
Yeah, UK makes up one of the big five. The big five being the five major nations and broadcasters.
The important countries, basically.
That put the most towards the Eurovision Song Contest. They being the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Spain and Italy. And so those five countries plus the previous year's winner then go through to the final automatically, and they don't have to go through selection processes.
Just want to say, by the way, Wogan RIP.
Oh yeah, yeah. Terry Wogan, who commentated for many, many years.
Do we know who it's going to be this year?
It's been Graham Norton for about half a decade.
Oh, has it?
Yeah, you've been paying attention.
Man, do you even watch this?
No, Terry Wogan.
Show.
I watched it on silent.
Terry
That's
Wogan.
That's probably the best way to watch it.
Quit the Eurovision because he was so sick of block voting in Eastern Europe. He was so sick of the fact that...
It was a political process.
Yeah, so. but then very recently we've had Sweden, Denmark, Austria be winners. Essentially. What do you think about the inclusion of countries like the Cocker States and Australia?
The caucuses. The caucuses.
So, like, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia.
The caucuses.
The caucuses.
You're saying cock again.
Well, you know, one-track mind.
The cock states, mate.
And Israel as well, in a European
context. I'm willing to pretend Israel is European because it has no friends. That's fine by me.
That is the reason.
I mean, it's an...
And Palestine allowed as well?
No.
Oh,
Palestine still isn't recognised as a...
I'm not sure they have a national broadcaster, do they?
Is that a requirement?
Yeah, that's the requirement. You need a national broadcaster. Don't you think... So, despite the terrible nature of the music that you think comes out of the Eurovision Song
Contest... I mean, it's just an objective fact.
It's a subjective opinion. Don't you think that it's actually done an awful lot of things in terms of showing a liberal Europe in the face of an encroaching Russia? For example, Conchita Wurst winning, despite the fact that there was a huge amount of homophobia in Russia that year.
Yeah.
We've had
Azerbaijan to actually, you know, claim a fig of legitimacy because they can host this event and pretend that everything is going wonderfully in their country.
No,
even
but
when
then
when they're clamping down on journalists' rights and sending people
that
to prison for opposing the government.
That year's winner, Loreen, came out in a press conference to say that this was wrong, that so many journalists were being detained, and that meant that a lot of people ended up talking about it.
Yeah,
I know
the
it's
damage is still kind of done, really, isn't it?
I don't know. Yeah. But the songs.
So what do you think of the actual acts going through this year? Do we like the act or not?
Oh, so Jack and Joe.
What do you think of Jack and Joe?
Total talentless wankers, aren't they?
It is terrible, and it's quite depressing
awful.
Also because
really
we have. So they were on The Voice, and they did reasonably well on The Voice UK. What was
I know where he was going with that.
Nearly as bad as that. Have you heard of this band called The Old Border?
No.
I mean,
what John's trying to say is my band is literally better than John and Jack or Joe and John or whoever the fuck they are.
I always forget what your band is called.
Shit.
Jimmy is part of
why I can speak with some authority on how bad the Eurovision is. Because,
I don't think so. How many number ones have you had?
I actually understand how music works, and I can therefore say that it is awful.
I understand how music works. I play the ukulele.
That doesn't count, does it?
It completely counts.
It doesn't
count. I know how music works.
Okay, Jimmy.
You press play and you hear music.
But don't you think that good has been done in the Eurovision in the past?
As I was saying to you earlier, I literally would vote to leave the EU purely on the basis that Eurovision was shut down. If that was part of the deal, which Cameron should have negotiated, he should have seen that coming.
That's not going to happen, though, because Nigel Farage says that he'd quite happily still stay in the Eurovision. He apparently quite likes it.
Oh, you know, he's an even worse human being than we previously realised.
Do you think Kanye West will gatecrush whoever wins?
He doesn't know what Eurovision is.
I don't know. He's begging for awards these days.
I don't think any of the Eurovision song contestants have had the best video of all time. So
he needs some exposure right now.
I think
that's what I'll do.
How,
get
why
up on stage
are we talking
and
about
say,
Kanye
please,
Bloody West?
I'm $53 million in personal debt. Please pray.
I mean, he could technically represent. He could technically represent a nation because either the singer or the songwriter need to be from the nation who are entering it. Which is how Celine Dion won in, like, the 80s with a French song where she represented Switzerland despite being a Canadian. And ABBA have also represented the UK in the past as well.
Really?
Yeah, because it was a British song.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is interesting, isn't it? Anyway, I feel like this was a really fun, like, less than 10 minutes talking about the Eurovision, but this is a very long podcast anyway.
Suddenly the Top Gear segment that we recorded a couple of weeks back doesn't look like such a bad idea.
If you guys, on any of the topics that we've talked about today, if you would like to wade in and have some banter with us, then please do. Why are you drinking? John, you're literally the worst person to have on the podcast. You're smelling candles and going, ooh, ah, and drinking out of your squeaky bottle.
I haven't done the worst thing.
Well, you've just deafened, like, half of our audience. Thank you very much. He's just hit the table. If you'd like to engage with us on social media, we're at Right Dishonour on Twitter, or you can go to our website, rightdishonourable.com. Give us some stars on iTunes, please. We want to be loved really badly.
I don't think we've been given stars since 2015.
Really? That's depressing.
Come on, give us some stars.
Give us some stars. Yeah. Tweet us when you give us some stars. Okay, this is ending now. Say goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Au revoir.
Oh, Jesus.